You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 12, given in Dornach on the 3rd of January, 1922. From what you have heard so far, you may have gained the impression that the art of education, based on anthroposophical knowledge of man, seeks to nurture, above all, a healthy and harmonious development of the child's physical body. You may have noticed that the following questions could be looked upon as guidelines for our educational aims. How can we assist the free unfolding of the formative forces issuing from the head and working upon and shaping the young organism? How do we work in harmony with the child's developing breathing and blood circulation during the middle years? What must we do in order to cultivate in the widest sense possible the forces working throughout the child's muscular system? How can we rightly support the processes of the muscles growing onto the bones through the tendons so that the young adolescent can place himself properly into the external world? All these questions imply that whatever we do to enhance the development of the child's soul and spirit is directed, first of all, toward the best possible healthy and normal development of its physical body. And this indeed is the case. We do aim in full consciousness to aid and foster the healthy development of the child's physical body. For in this way the child's soul and spiritual nature is given the best means of unfolding freely and out of its own resources. By damaging as little as possible the spiritual forces working through the child, we give it the best possibility of developing healthily. Not that we have our preconceived ideas of what a growing human being should be like. Whatever we do in our teaching is an attempt to create the most favorable conditions for the children's physical health, and because we have to pay attention also to the soul and spiritual element, because the physical must ultimately become its outer expression, its manifestation, we have to come to terms also with the soul and spiritual aspect in the way best suited for the healthy development of the child. You may ask, from which educational ideal does such an attitude spring? It is the outcome of a total dedication toward human freedom. It springs from the ideal to place the human being into the world in such a way that he can unfold his individual freedom, or at least that no physical hindrances should prevent him from doing so. What we are specially striving for in our education, with its emphasis on the promotion of the physical development of the child, is that our pupils should learn to make full use of their physical powers and skills in their later lives. Waldorf education rests upon the knowledge and the confidence that life in general will have the best chance of developing if it is allowed to develop freely and healthily. Naturally, all this has to be taken in a relative sense, which I hope will be understood. A child which, through educational malpractice during the school years, has been prevented from breathing rightly and from using its bony system with its tendons properly, will grow into an unfree person. Likewise, a pupil into whose head fixed ideas and conceptions were crammed because they were deemed important for later life will also become inwardly unfree. Only he whose childhood needs imposed by his physical development, read that again, only he whose childhood needs imposed by his physical development were both understood and catered for by the use of appropriate educational principles and methods, will grow into a free human being. Naturally, the soul and spiritual needs of the child must also be recognized and met by the right educational means. Far from leading to any kind of false or lofty idealism, Anthroposophy wishes to prove itself by enabling its followers to deal with the practical problems of life between birth and death, that is, during the span of time in which they should have developed their physical bodies in accord with their souls and spirits. So you see that even we, the educators, wanted it. Read it again. So you see that even if we, the educators, wanted it, we have no influence over the development of what belongs to the realm of soul and spirit. The soul and spiritual part of man exists in its true being only from the moment of his falling asleep until the time of awakening. This means that if one wanted to educate a person's soul and spirit, one would have to do so during his sleep. In fact, it is not possible for us to do so. The belief that one has to educate a person's soul and spirit, the belief in indoctrinating certain conceptions, is something we meet so strongly in a time like ours. All one can do is to help toward a free use of physical capabilities by means of the soul and spirit. As I have often said before, it is not possible to deal with educational matters without taking into full account the entire life situation of our times, without considering the general milieu into which education is placed. I will certainly refrain from introducing any extraneous matter into our considerations here, but what I wish to say now definitely belongs to our theme. News has come to us that in Eastern Europe a new pedagogy is being worked out for the benefit of those people who are still recognized there, namely for the people who belong to the Radical Socialist Party. Because anything that was acceptable prior to the revolution is no longer regarded as right, a new pedagogy is being worked out there now. And this is done by purely outward means. How? We are told that one of the leading personalities in present-day Russia has been commissioned to write the history of the Communist Party. The new government has given him 1 month in which to complete his task. During this month, he is also to do some practical work at the Moscow Center. As a result of these activities, a book is to be published, which is to become the officially accepted model for the re-education of all those who are being recognized as proper Russians. A second party member has been commissioned to write a history of the Western workers' movement and a history of international communism. While compiling his authoritative account, this person, too, has been given some other work to do, and after 6 weeks he is to have completed his set task. Again, every genuine Soviet Russian is to occupy himself with this book. Forgive me, I believe that the second writer was actually given 2 months' time. A third person was commissioned to publish The Theory of Marxism, and it was he who had been given 6 weeks to deliver the book, with the aid of which every true Russian is to familiarize himself with the new conditions in the East. According to these same methods, several other personalities have been given the task of creating the new Russian literature. Every one of them has been allotted a fixed time schedule in which to complete his order. Every one of them has been told what other work he has to perform during the time of writing. The party member selected to write the book about Marxism has also been made co-editor of Pravda. Why should I bring this up in today's lecture? Because fundamentally, what is happening in Soviet Russia today is the ultimate consequence of what lives in all of us, in as far as we are representatives of our present-day civilization. People will not admit that what is happening in Russia is but the final consequence of our own situation, taken to extremes in Eastern Europe. The absurdity of communist ideology lies in the fact that it is decided and laid down officially what a citizen has to know, instead of the question being asked, quote, how must a human being behave in order to be a true human being? That is, one who is rightly integrated into the entire world fabric, close quote. The teacher is called upon to carry into his lessons the utmost respect for soul and spirit. Without it, he will succeed as little as if he were lacking an even fundamental artistic and scientific background. Therefore, the first prerequisite of a Waldorf teacher is to have reverence for the soul and spiritual potential which each child brings with it into the world. When confronted with the child, the teacher must be imbued with the awareness that he is dealing with an innately free human being. With this attitude, he will be able to work out educational principles and methods which will safeguard the child's inborn freedom, so that in later life, when a pupil looks back upon his school days, he will not find any infringement upon his personal freedom, not even in the after effects of his education. In order to make clearer what these statements imply, we might ask ourselves the following question. What will become of a person if his physical peculiarities are not dealt with properly during childhood? Childish idiosyncrasies continue their existence into later life. And if you wonder what kind of effect they will have on an adult, I have to make what may appear as rather a surprising and a somewhat paradoxical statement. Peculiar physical habits in early childhood, if left untreated, will degenerate and become causes of illnesses in later life. One has to know in all seriousness that characteristic physical tendencies in childhood, if allowed to continue unchanged, become causes of illness. This knowledge will give one the right impulse for a proper hygiene, which in no way conflicts with the deepest respect for human freedom. By way of comparison, let us imagine somebody who, right down to the deepest fibers of his being, is filled with enthusiasm for the inner freedom of man. Let us imagine that such a person falls ill and that he has to call the doctor. The doctor cures him with the aid of all the best modern means available to the art of healing. Would such a person ever feel that his personal freedom had thereby been interfered with? Never. What comes toward such a person in this way would never impinge upon his inner freedom. A similar feeling must also be present in those who are engaged in the art of education. They ought to be willing and able to look at their calling in the light of the relationship between doctor and patient. Education obviously exists in its own right. It certainly is no mere therapy in the true sense of the word. But there is a certain kinship, a certain similarity between the work of a doctor and that of a teacher, which justifies a comparison with the therapeutic situation. When the pupil leaves school at the age of 14 plus, footnote, in 1922 the school leaving age was 14, end of footnote, it is time for us to examine once more whether, during his school years, from the change of teeth to the coming of puberty, we have done our utmost to help and equip him for later life. During the coming days, when dealing with the aesthetic and moral aspects of education, we shall look more closely at the stage of puberty. Just now we will consider the more general human aspects. We must realize that during his past school years, we have been dealing mainly with his etheric body, with his body of formative forces, and that the soul life, of which more will be said a little later, was only beginning to manifest itself toward the approach of his school-leaving age. We must consider the next stage, which begins with the 14th to 15th year, and which continues right up to the beginning of the 20s. A time in which the young man or woman has to face the task of fitting himself or herself more and more into external life. We have already seen how gradually the child takes hold of its body, finally incarnating right into its skeleton, and how by doing so it grows together more and more with the external world, how it learns to adapt to outer circumstances. Fundamentally, this process continues up to the early 20s, after which there follows a most important period of life. Although as teachers we now no longer have any direct influence over the young person, we have in fact already done a great deal in this direction during the previous years, and this will become apparent from the early to the late 20s. After leaving school, the young person has to undergo a training for a particular vocation. Now, he or she no longer receives what has mainly come out of human nature itself, but rather what has become part and parcel of the civilization we live in, at least with regard to a chosen trade or profession. Now, the young person has to be adaptable to certain forms of specialization. In our Waldorf school, we try to prepare this stepping out into life by introducing practical crafts, such as spinning and weaving, to our 14 and 15-year-olds. To gain practical experience in such crafts is not only important for a future spinner or weaver, but for every person who wishes to be able to turn his hand to anything that a given situation may demand. However, it is important to introduce the right activities at the right time. Now, what has been cultivated in a child's etheric body or body of formative forces during the early school years re-emerges in the soul sphere of a young person during his or her 20s, that is, at the time when he or she has to enter a profession. The way in which he was treated at school will be largely instrumental in his responding to outer conditions, either clumsily, reluctantly, full of inhibitions, or skillfully, and with an inner strength to overcome obstacles. During his 20s, the young person will certainly become aware of how the experiences of his school years first went underground, as it were, while he was training for a trade or profession, only to surface again in form of capacities, such as being able to handle certain situations or to fit oneself into life in the right way. A teacher who is aware of these facts will pay due attention to the critical moments in the life of the pupil between the change of teeth and puberty. During the 9th to 10th year, there occurs the important turning point of life of which I have repeatedly spoken. Toward the 12th year, another important change takes place, which I have already mentioned. The 6 to 7-year-old child, on entering school, is what I have previously called one great sense organ. At that stage, a great deal has already been absorbed by imitation. The child has also been engaged in the inner process of molding and sculpting its organs, the result of which it brings to school. And now, everything the teacher does with the young pupil until the turning point at 9+ should have a formative effect, but in such a way that the child feels stimulated to participate freely and actively in this inner shaping or forming. I have already indicated this by my strong appeal for an artistic approach during the introduction to reading, writing, and arithmetic. The artistic element is of particular importance at this age. Everyone who knows that all teaching during the early school years has to proceed from the child's will sphere, and that only gradually should it lead over toward the intellect, will pay special attention to the education of the child's will. He will know that the child must learn to drive out its will forces from its own organism, but in the right way. In order to bring this about, the child's will activities need to be tinged with an element of feeling. It is not enough for the teacher to do different things with his children. He must also develop sympathy and antipathy in accordance with what they are doing. And the musical element, quite apart from music in its own right, offers the best means for achieving it. Therefore, as soon as the child is brought to us, we ought to immerse it in the element of music, not only through singing, but also by letting it experience music-making with simple instruments. In this way, the young pupil will not only nurture an aesthetic sense, but above all, though in a roundabout way, he or she will learn how to use and to control will forces in an harmonious manner. Child brings many inborn gifts to school. Inwardly, it is a natural sculptor, and we can draw on these sculptural gifts as well as on its inner hidden talents. As well as on its other hidden talents. For instance, we can let children do all kinds of things with liquid paints on paper, even if this can be inconvenient for the teacher. And in this way, we can introduce them to the secrets of color. It is really fascinating to observe how a child will relate itself to color when left to cover a white surface with various patches of color. What it produces in an apparently haphazard manner is not at all meaningless. For in all the blotches and smears, one can detect a certain color harmony resulting from an inborn kinship to the world of color. Only one must be careful not to let children use the kind of solid blocks of color which are sold in children's paint boxes, where they are supposed to paint directly from the blocks onto the paper. This always has a damaging effect, even in the case of painting as an art. One ought to paint with liquid colors, with colors already dissolved in water or any other suitable liquid. It is important to develop an intimate relationship with color, especially in the case of children. If one uses thick paints from a palette, one does not have the same intimate relationship to color as one does if one is using liquid colors out of paint jars. In a painting lesson, you could say to the child, quote, "What you have painted here is really beautiful. You have put red in the middle, and all the other colors around it go well with the red. Everything you have painted fits well together with the red in the middle. Now try to do it the other way round. Where you have red, paint blue, and then paint around it all the other colors, so that they also go well with the blue in the middle." Close quote. Not only will the child be tremendously stimulated by an exercise of this kind, but by working out such a transposition of colors, possibly with a certain amount of help from the teacher, it will gain a great deal in establishing an inner relationship to the world in general. However inconvenient it may be for the teacher, he or she should always encourage the young pupils to form shapes of all kinds out of any suitable material he can lay his hands on. True, one should avoid letting children get unduly dirty and messy, for this can be a real nuisance. But what children gain in these creative activities is worth far more than that they should remain clean and tidy. In short, especially during the early years, it is of great value for them to gain experience of the artistic element. Anything that has to come from the child first has to be induced in a way appropriate to its nature. And if artistic activities are introduced in the way indicated, the learning of other subjects will also become easier. Foreign languages, for example, will be learned with far greater ease if pupils have done artistic work beforehand. I have already mentioned that learning of foreign languages should begin at a very early age, if possible as soon as a child enters school. Nowadays, one often encounters rather fanatical attitudes, so that something which in itself is quite right and justifiable tends to become exaggerated to the point of a fanatical one-sidedness, and the teaching of foreign languages is no exception. The child learns its mother tongue naturally, that is, without any grammatical consciousness, and this is how it should be. And when it enters school, it should learn foreign languages in a similar way, namely without any grammatical awareness, although this time the process of learning a language will naturally be a more mature and conscious one. However, during the 10th year, at the turning point of life, mentioned already several times, the new situation calls for the introduction to the first fundamentals of grammar. These should be taught without any pedantry whatever. It is necessary to take this new step for the benefit of the child's healthy development, for at this age it has to make the transition from a predominantly feeling approach to life to one in which it has to unfold its ego consciousness. Whatever the young person is doing has now to be done more consciously than hitherto. Consequently, we must introduce a more conscious and intellectual element into the language, which meanwhile the pupil has learned to speak, write, and read. But when doing so, we must avoid pedantic grammar exercises. Instead, we should give the children stimulating practice in recognizing and applying fundamental rules. At this stage, the child really needs the logical support which a knowledge of grammar can give, so that it does not have to puzzle time and again over how to express itself correctly. We must realize that language contains two main elements which always play into each other, namely an emotional or feeling element and an intellectual thinking element. I should like to give you an illustration of this with a quotation from Goethe's Faust. Quote, "Gray, dear friend, is every theory, and green, the golden tree of life." Close quote. I am not expecting from you, our guests who have mainly come from the West, that you should study all the commentaries on Goethe's Faust, for there are enough of them to fill a whole library. Footnote, these repeat lectures were given to foreign visitors, most of whom had come from Western countries. End of footnote. However, if you did so, you would make a strange discovery. When coming to this sentence in Faust, most likely you would find a remark at the bottom of the page, duly equipped with yet a new number, at least a four-figure number, because of all the many previous explanations already given. You would find there a comment about the lack of logic inherent in this sentence, despite the poetic license granted to any reputable author. So the commentator might point out, "The colors of the tree in this stanza do not make sense. A golden tree does not mean an orange tree. Does this not mean an orange tree? But then it would not be green. If it were an ordinary tree, it would not be golden. Perhaps Goethe had in mind an artificial tree. At any rate, so a typical commentary would continue, a tree cannot be golden and green at the same time. Then there is this other problem of a gray theory. How can a theory be gray if it is something invisible? In this way, many commentaries point out the lack of logic in this sentence. There are, of course, also other, more artistically inclined commentators who take delight in the apparent lack of logic in this passage. But what is really at the bottom of it all? It is the fact that in this sentence, on the one side, the emotional, the feeling element in language predominates, whereas on the other, the more thoughtful, image-like aspect is stressed. When Goethe speaks of a golden tree, he implies that one would love the tree as one loves gold. The word gold here does not bear an image-like quality, but it reveals the warmth of feeling engendered by the glow of gold. Here only the feelings are portrayed. The adjective green, on the other hand, refers to an ordinary tree, such as we see it in nature. This is the logic of it. With regard to the word theory, a theory is, of course, invisible. Yet rightly or wrongly, the mere word may conjure up certain feelings in some people, which are reminiscent of those in a London fog. It is quite possible to transfer such a feeling to the concept of theory. The purely feeling element of language is again expressed in the adjective gray. The feeling and thinking quality in language intermingles everywhere. In contemporary languages, much has already been lamed, but during their earlier stages, there lived everywhere an active and creative element through which the feeling and thinking qualities came into existence. As mentioned already, before the age of 9, the child has an entirely feeling relationship to language. Yet unless we also introduce the thinking element inherent in language, the child's self-consciousness cannot develop properly. And this is the reason why it is so important for us to bring to the child the intellectual aspect of language. This can be done by a judicious teaching of grammatical rules, first of all in the mother tongue, and subsequently also in foreign languages, whereby the rules should be introduced only after the child has already begun to speak the language. And so, in accordance with the indications given, the teacher should arouse the feeling in the pupil, aged 9 to 10, that he or she is now beginning to penetrate the language more consciously, This is how a proper grammatical sense could be cultivated in the child. By the time the pupil reaches the age of 12, he should have developed a feeling for the beauty of language, that is, an aesthetic sense of the language. This should stimulate him to aim at what one might call beauty in speaking, without, however, his ever falling into any mannerisms. From then on, until the time of puberty, the pupil should learn to appreciate the dialectical aspect of language. He should develop the faculty of convincing another person through his command of language. This third element of language should be introduced only when the pupil is approaching school-leaving age. Footnote: in 1922, the official school-leaving age was 14. End of footnote. Briefly summarizing the aims of language teaching, one could say first the child should develop step by step a feeling for the correct use of language, then a sense of beauty of language, and finally he should learn to experience the power inherent in linguistic command. It is far more important for the teacher to find his way into such an approach to language teaching than for him merely to follow a fixed curriculum. In this way, he will soon find out how to introduce and deal with what is needed for the various ages. After a predominantly artistic approach, in which the pupil up to 9+ is involved very actively, the teacher should begin to dwell more on the descriptive element in language, without, however, neglecting the creative aspect. This is certainly possible if one chooses the kind of syllabus which I have tried to characterize during these past 2 days, where the introduction of nature study leads to geography, and where the animals are seen within the context of man. The most effective way of including the descriptive element would be if the teacher appealed mainly to the child's soul sphere rather than claiming its entire being. This should be done by his clothing the lesson content in a story form, told in a vivid and imaginative style. In like manner, at this stage of life, the teacher should present historical content by giving lively accounts of human events, which in themselves form a whole, as already indicated. Having gone through the stage of spontaneous activity, which was followed by an appreciation of the descriptive element, the pupil, approaching the 12th year, is ready for what could be called the explanatory approach. Now cause and effect enter general considerations, and content can be given, which will stretch the powers of reasoning. Throughout these stages, the mathematical aspects in all their manifold forms need to be presented, naturally in a way appropriate to the pupil's age. The mathematical element, such as it is taught in arithmetic and geometry, is liable to cause quite special difficulties to a teacher. Before the 9th year, this work is introduced in its simpler forms, to be subsequently expanded. For the child is well able to take in a great deal if one knows how to proceed in the right way. Now, it is a fact that all mathematical content which is taught throughout the entire time spent at school must also be presented in a thoroughly artistic and imaginative way. By all kinds of means, the teacher must contrive to introduce the arithmetical and geometrical content artistically, and here, too, between the 9th and 10th year, he has to go over to a descriptive method. The pupil has to be taught how to observe angles, triangles, quadrilaterals, and so on, through a descriptive method. Proofs should not enter the work before the 12th year. A boring math teacher will achieve extremely little, if anything at all, whereas a teacher inspired by this subject will succeed in making it into a stimulating and exhilarating experience for his pupils. For after all, it is by grace of mathematics that fundamentally we are able to experience the harmonies of ideal space. If a teacher can wax enthusiastic over the theorem of Pythagoras, or over the inner harmonies between planes and solid bodies, he will bring something into these lessons which is of immense importance for the child, also with regard to its soul development. Through his contributions, he will counteract the element of confusion with which life presents us everywhere. You see, Language could not exist without the constant intermingling of the element of thought and feeling. Once again, I have made a very radical statement. But if you were to examine the various languages, you would discover everywhere how feeling and thinking are constantly interwoven. This in itself, as well as many other factors, could easily introduce a certain chaos into our lives, were it not for the inner firmness which mathematics especially can bestow upon us. Anyone able to look more deeply into life will know that many people have been saved from falling victim to neurasthenia, hysteria, and even worse afflictions simply because they learned how to observe triangles, quadrilaterals, tetrahedra, and other geometrical realities in the right way. Perhaps I may be allowed here a more personal note, because it may help to clarify the point I am making. I have a special love for mechanics, not only because of its objective value, but very much for personal reasons. And I owe this love of mechanics to the enthusiasm for this subject displayed by one of my teachers in the Vienna High School, for such things live on into later life. This teacher glowed with excitement when searching for the resultants from given components. It was so interesting to witness the joy with which he was looking for the resultants, and with which he would take them apart again in order to fit them back into their components. While doing this, he almost jumped and danced from one end of the blackboard to the other, until full of glee, he would finally call out the formula he had found, such as C squared equals A squared plus B squared. Captivated by his findings, which he had written on the board, he would look around at his audience with a benign smile, which in itself was enough to kindle enthusiasm for analytical mechanics, a subject which usually hardly evokes such feelings in people. It is really important that mathematics, which is taught in its various forms and aspects right through the school, should pour out, as it were, its own special substance over all the pupils. And so we can speak of the two poles in human development, the rhythmic artistic pole and the mathematical conceptual one. And if, in the way indicated, the young soul is worked upon from within in an outward direction, the pupil will gradually grow into the world in the right way. At the approach of the school leaving age, the teacher will feel an inner need once more to survey the most significant moments in the development of his or her pupils during the last 2 years, this time in retrospect. The pupils entered school in class 1 at the age of 6 or 7. A few years later they were sent out into the world again, and, as I indicated at the beginning of today's lecture, it is the teacher's aim to enable them to adapt themselves to the life of the world. When we receive the young pupil in class 1, he is like one great sense organ. Within, he bears a kind of copy or a stamp of his parents, of other people in his surroundings, and of his entire social background. It is our task to transmute these adopted and specialized features into more general human features. This we can do by appealing, above all, to the child's middle system of breathing and blood circulation, which is not so much bound up with the more personal sides of the human being. Yet, apart from these adopted features, which the child unconsciously has copied from its environment, it also bears its very own individual characteristics when it enters school. These are less pronounced than similar characteristics found also in adults, features which we associate with the melancholic, sanguine, phlegmatic, or choleric temperaments. Nevertheless, the child's nature, too, is definitely colored by what could be called its temperamental disposition, so that we can speak of children with melancholic, phlegmatic, sanguine, and choleric tendencies. It is essential for teachers to acquire a fine perception for the manifold symptoms and characteristics resulting from the children's temperamental dispositions, and to find the right way of dealing with them. The melancholic child is the one to depend most strongly on the conditions of its physical body. Due to its special constitution, it tends to feel weighed down by its bodily nature. It easily becomes self-centered and generally little interested in what is going on around it. Yet it would be wrong to think of the melancholic child simply as being inattentive, for it is so only with regard to its surroundings and to what comes from the teacher. It is very attentive to its own inner conditions, and this is the reason why a melancholic child tends to be so moody. Please note that what I am saying about the temperaments applies only to children whose symptoms cannot be automatically transferred to grown-ups of the same temperament. The relationship of the phlegmatic child to its environment is one of complete, though entirely subconscious, surrender to the world at large. And as the world is vast and so full of things to which it has surrendered itself, it shows only little interest for what is near at hand. Parenthesis again, my remarks about this temperament refer only to the child. Otherwise, they might be looked upon as being a compliment to the phlegmatic adult, and this they certainly are not meant to be. Close parenthesis. Making rather a sweeping statement, one could say, if a child with phlegmatic tendencies did not happen to live on earth, if it were living out there in the heavenly world, in the cosmos, it would be full of the deepest interest in its surroundings. For the phlegmatic child really feels at home in the periphery of the world. It is open for what is immense and for what does not make an immediate impact because of its vastness and remoteness. To a certain extent, the sanguine child displays opposite characteristics to those of the melancholic or phlegmatic child. The young melancholic is immersed in his bodily nature. The phlegmatic child feels drawn outward to the spheres of infinity because it is so strongly linked to its etheric body, or body of formative forces. The etheric body is always inclined to strive outward toward an infinite totality. It disperses itself into the cosmos already a few days after death. The sanguine child lives in what we call the astral body or the soul body. This member of the human being is different from the physical or etheric bodies, inasmuch as it does not concern itself with what is of a temporal or spatial nature. It exists beyond the realm of time and space. It is due to the astral body that during every moment of our lives we have an awareness of our entire life up to the present moment, even though our memories of earlier experiences are generally weaker than those of more recent ones. The astral body is mainly instrumental in directing our dreams. These, as you know, bear little relationship to the correct sequence of time. We may dream about something that happened only yesterday, yet mixed up in the dream, people may appear whom we met already in early childhood. The astral body mixes up all our life experiences. It has no regard for the element of time and space. But in its chaotic ways, it has its own dimension, which is totally different from what is temporal and spatial. The sanguine child surrenders itself to its astral body, and this becomes evident in its entire pattern of behavior. It responds to outer impressions as if what lies beyond time and space were directly transmitted to us through the outer world itself. It quickly responds to impressions without digesting them inwardly, because it does not care for the time element. It simply surrenders itself to its astral body. It makes no efforts to retain outer impressions. Or again, it does not like to live in memories of earlier happenings. Because it pays so little heed to the element of time, the sanguine child lives in and for the present moment. It brings to outer expression what in reality is the task of the astral body in the higher worlds, and this gives the sanguine child a certain superficiality. The choleric child is most directly linked to its ego center. Its very build shows a strong will nature, which, permeated by the forces of its ego, is apt to enter life aggressively. It is really important for the teacher to cultivate a fine perception for the characteristic features of the various temperaments in the growing children. In a twofold way, he must try to deal with them. First, by introducing a certain social element in the classroom, which is based on the various temperaments. When he has got an idea of his pupils as a whole, he should place them in groups according to similarity of temperaments. There are, of course, children of mixed temperaments, and this too has to be considered. But in general it has a salutary effect if children of the same temperament are seated together, for the simple reason that then the temperaments rub up against each other. The melancholic child, for example, will have a neighbor who is also a melancholic. It will become aware of how this neighbor is suffering from all kinds of discomforts arising out of the physical constitution. The melancholic pupil will recognize similar symptoms in himself, and the mere looks of his neighbor will have a healing effect upon his own nature. If phlegmatic children sit next to other phlegmatics, they will become so bored with them that in the end their own phlegma becomes stirred up to the extent that they will try to shake off their own lethargy. The sanguine child, when seated among other sanguines, will see how they flutter from one impression to the next, being momentarily interested now in one thing and then in another, until it feels like brushing them away like flies. Experiencing its own traits in its neighbors, the sanguine child becomes aware of the superficiality of its own sanguine temperament. If the cholerics are seated together, there will be such a constant exchange of blows that the resulting bruises which they give each other will have an extraordinarily healing effect upon their temperament. You must observe these things, and then you will find that by introducing, through your choice of seating, a social element in the classroom, the result will have a wholesome and balancing effect upon each child. In this way, the teacher's relationship to each of the temperaments can also find its rightful expression. The second point to be borne in mind is that it would be not at all helpful to treat a melancholic child, or that of any other temperament for that matter, by going against its inherent disposition. On the contrary, one should develop the habit of treating like with like. If, for instance, one were to force a choleric child to sit still and to be quiet, the result would be an accumulation of suppressed choler which would act like a poison in its system. It simply would not work. On the other hand, if, for example, the teacher shows continued interest and understanding for the doleful moods of a melancholic child, his attitude will finally bring about a beneficial and healing effect. When dealing with a phlegmatic child, outwardly, one should appear also rather phlegmatic and somewhat indifferent, despite one's real inner interest in the pupil. The sanguine child should be subjected to many quickly changing sense impressions. In this way, one would increase the tendencies of its own temperament, with the result that the child will try to catch up with the many fleeting impressions. It will develop a stronger intensity. The sheer number of sense impressions will bring about an inner effort of self-intensification in the child. It is by treating like with like that one can really come to grips with the different temperaments. As for the choleric children, if conditions at school would allow it, I should like it best to send them out into the garden during the afternoons and let them run about until they were exhausted. I should let them climb up and down the trees. When one of them had reached a treetop, I should let him shout across to his playmate sitting on top of another tree. I should let them shout at each other until they were tired out. If one allows a choleric child to free itself in a natural way from pent-up choler, one exercises a most healing influence upon its temperament. In getting to know the nature of the different temperaments, one can learn to work effectively as a teacher. However, there is one thing which is essential. It really is no good at all if a teacher enters his classroom with a morose demeanor, which already at a comparatively early age in his life has engraved deep wrinkles on his face. He must know how to act with a great sense of humor in the classroom. He must be able to enter into everything that comes toward him from the class. He must be able to let his own being flow into that of his children. The end of Lecture 12.